Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Yo, yo, what up? This is Fonte Fontigolo, and I'm here with this week's QLS Classic. This week, we go back to February 7th, 2019, with our Black TV Writers Roundtable Part 1. In this episode, we break down the state of Black Hollywood with acclaimed writers and very good friends of mine, Tracy Ashley, Diallo Riddle, Bashir Saladin, and Angela Nissel. They all get real with Team Supreme on Part 1 of this two-part Black TV Writers Roundtable, and it was a lot of fun. So check it out. QLS. Yeah.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Black Writers Symposium.
Yeah.
Questlove, you heard?
Yeah.
Trapped in a room.
Yeah.
With nine nerds.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
My name is Fonte.
Yeah.
I ain't no phony.
Yeah.
I'm just here to help Angie.
Yeah.
Pay her alimony.
Roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema. Suprema roll call.
It was younger.
Yeah.
Before Laia was born.
Yeah.
I used to watch on TV.
Yeah.
Scrambled porn.
Roll call. Yeah. Suprema. Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Bashir and Diallo.
Yeah.
Man, I almost forgot you.
Yeah.
Oh, now I remember.
Yeah.
Hubble got you.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
It's Laia.
Yeah.
And I'm here to impress.
Yeah.
All these folks in here.
Yeah.
With my writing prowess.
Roll call.
Yeah.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is Tracy.
Yeah.
But you can call me Trey.
Yeah.
I worked all day.
Yeah.
So I could earn my pay.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name's Bashir.
Yeah.
And I was late.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of black people here.
Yeah.
So shit is great.
Roll call.
Get it.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name's Diallo.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah.
Pulled up in Sunset Sound.
Yeah.
In my shiny new car.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
My name is And.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah.
If I say some dumb shit.
Yeah.
Then blame Bashir.
Roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Suprema roll call.
Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call. Suprema, Suprema roll call.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a special Black Hollywood Symposium of Questlove Supreme.
Shout out to Barney Miller.
Right. From Last Comic Standing, yo. The Wanda Sykes Hilarious, The Neighborhood with Cedric the Entertainer, The Last OG, it's Tracy Ashley.
Hey!
Yo!
Fresh from Chocolate News, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, please come back. Maya Marty, Southside, Marlon, Rise, The Last OG. It's Diallo Riddle.
Yeah. Wah-wah.
Lick a shot. Lick a shot.
From Glow, Superstore, Gringo, Kirby Enthusiasm, Snatch, The Tonight Show, and Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, The Mindy Project, Bones, Grey's Anatomy, Arrested Development, so much more. And yes, The Last OG. We have, I ran out of theme. I'll do it again. Anywho, we have.
What's up?
Bashir
Saladin. Saladin.
I've known Questlove for like 20 years, and he still can't say my last name.
I can't say most words. Anyway, Bashir Saladin, ladies and
What's
gentlemen.
Good?
He said most words.
Yeah, and ladies and gentlemen, finally, from OK Player. Nah, y'all. From the Boondocks, from Scrubs, from Till Death, from Tyler, the Creator's The Jellies, and The Last OG. Give it up for the one and only Angela Nissel.
Yo.
You know,
stress.
At the time when I
okay.
when I requested this show, I thought it was going to be like this very serious
a special edition of Questlove mm-hmm. Supreme.
Yeah, like the Meredith Baxter Bernie.
Yeah. Yeah, the different strokes. Dudley
goes to the bike
Dudley
store.
Goes to the bike store with the pedal nigga.
Mr. Gump.
Right.
And Gordon Jump.
Instead, terrible. I see the alcohol here, so I realize this.
You know what time it is.
Well, we're live at Sunset Sound.
Shout out to Sunset Sound. We're in the famous Studio 3.
Yes. With Prince and, you know, all of his classic albums from 82 to 87. Also Led Zeppelin, The Doors.
The Doors recorded The Doors here?
Yeah.
Oh, right on.
So the Doobie Brothers also recorded here and so many others.
Toto.
Toto as well.
Toto did do it here, yeah.
The Jacksons.
Imagine Dragons.
Wait, you said Toto or
Toto?
I'm joking. You said Toto.
Imagine Dragons.
All right. You said Toto, right? Not Toto. Toto. Oh.
Yeah, not Toto.
Well, hold on now. But where did Toto record?
Let's do the next podcast there. With Toto.
Where did Toto record?
I'd be like, they recorded Kissing You right here.
Well, I know that Boss Bill and Fonte would be very happy about that.
I cut for Toto.
I'm with it.
Me not so much. Anywho, no, I like Total. I love Total. Okay,
we're not talking about the cereal.
Kima, Keisha, Pam. Shout
you
out.
Read
to
the
him.
Book.
I actually always talk about the cereal.
Wow,
no, I'm cool. I'm only doing that because I know that you guys.
Got a girl crush on Keisha. My first. I'm sorry.
We should talk about Total.
Hey, you know SWV's first name was TLC.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah. Originally.
How do you know that?
I know a lot of random facts.
Nine nerds in a room.
Oh, all a R&B, all the R&B nerds.
Nine nerds in a room. Okay, so why did we all gather here today?
Free wine.
Okay. Who's paying for this wine?
Actually, shout out to Yami. He got it from somewhere for free, but we appreciate that he gave it to us. He could have gave it to anybody, but he gave it to us.
Shout out to the plug. Nice.
It came in a box, and it's really delicious.
Yeah, and it's
oh,
good
the box
shit.
Of wine? The box of wine. Damn. Now I'm about to bring the mood down.
Now, let's talk about the state of Black Hollywood and writers.
Oh, I need some more wine. Hold up.
Hello. Washer, can you hand Tracy that bottle of wine?
Give me the bottle. State of Hollywood. Give me the
take
bottle.
The whole wine and save take me the last wine. Time a black woman ran a network half hour.
Okay, well, since the four of you have the last OG in common.
Good show, by the way. Y'all should.
That's crazy. Watch that show, man. All of us have worked
it's
on that
hilarious.
Show.
All of you have.
Yes. Watched the last OG.
Yes. What is everyone's specific role or what role did you play in, you can go around the room, in that show since you all have that in common?
From who got the first one? Who got the call first? Who was the first?
Dialma and Bashir were on the first season.
Yeah, okay. We were season one.
We were consulting producers on the show. Yeah. And Jordan Peele.
Can you explain what consulting producers are?
You know, it's really just
is that like
people who show up sometimes.
Homeboy. Okay,
I'll be honest. It's a little arbitrary. The titles are sometimes kind of conferred based on the level they want to give you, based on how much they want to pay you. But really, we kind of all do the same thing. We go in, we all talk about it, we all try to figure out how to make the show better. It's not really an actual unless you're like a writer assistant.
Sometimes consulting producers, they only come in a couple of days a week. But you and I,
we didn't have really that. Else, we didn't so have we that privilege. Yeah, we had to come in every day.
Kind of like Will Smith's West Philly homeboy consultant that was always credited at the end of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Mm. Oh yeah.
By the way, I met Harry Smith last night. So shout out to Mr. Harry Smith
Will Smith's brother. Oh, Harry, as in Ellen and Harry. Okay.
I'm enjoying the show already. I would like to say that I'm co-executive producer on the last OG. So the first time, I found out that I got paid more than men.
Hey.
Yeah.
It only took you how long? Like
big shouts.
20 years?
Big shouts.
5,000 books.
Big shouts. Shouts out to them dollars.
Yeah, well, so I know that there's a major difference, will be a major difference in season two than season one. Can you tell the difference between the two without burning bridges or getting fired?
I didn't watch season one. No, I'm kidding.
Well, no. take us through the process of how a show runs.
Woo. I mean, it's what basically happened is I know that in season one, There's only two people left over. Tracy, you can help me.
Yeah, I think
because
it's just...
Tracy actually opens up for Tracy Morgan on the road.
That's right. Okay. Oh wow!
Yeah, so she could actually might be able to tell you more about the differences of season one, season two.
Sure, sure. I wasn't in the room, so I can't speak. I think these two could speak more to it. But one,
I was in the room.
Yeah. So Bashir was in the room. There's only two other people that I know: Mark Theobald and Dr. Kirkpatrick that came back.
Patrick.
So they
got shout out.
They overhauled the entire writers' room.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
The entire writer's room got over.
Pretty much.
And by the way, who did that?
I would say, Tracy and Jordan? I'm not sure.
It's a lot more brown.
That's definitely more brown. Yeah. Completely changed.
Well, when Bashir and I arrived, like Ms. Kilpatrick was just, she was very excited to see us.
She was alone in there, huh?
It was a very different kind of room.
Okay.
Yeah.
And no offense to anybody who was in that room, but it was nice to have like a little injection of us. And that, by the way, that was also when Jordan's movie was blowing up, so he couldn't be there every single day. So, you know, it was, And I mean, like, I think it kind of shows because when Bashir and I showed up, the script said, you know, one POV, and I think that we helped, you know, bring it to a POV that
worked a lot of hours, is what he's trying to say.
Yeah, a lot of midnight oil. A
lot of time. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it was just assumed that because Tracy came from 30 Rock, where, you know, the element of Tracy Morgan was allowed to be shown in that particular way. Well, also know that Donald Glover wrote all of his dialogue for that show, but that it was okay in their eyes to a lot of sigh.
No. I didn't. I learned that's new information. I didn't know that.
You didn't know that Tina Fey hired Donald Glover specifically to write of Tracy Morgan's dialogue.
TV shows are really, I'll put it this way, and all the writers in here can agree, it's really mysterious. So, like, even when somebody wins an award and they go on stage, that actually might not be the person who contributed the most to that episode.
Yes.
That's right.
So you really don't know who does what until somebody like you just now tells us.
Yes, I will get cursed out online for an episode, and I'll be like, it has your name on it. People understand. I literally wrote two sentences in that episode.
We talk about
I just
that
thought
all
it was common knowledge that
it's not common knowledge. No.
We learned
for
it.
Real?
We learned
I knew he wrote on the show. I didn't know he was hired.
And also, you're a werewolf bar mitzvah.
Googling.
But,
listen, we call it a writer's room.
It's a full moon. Donald Glover.
On the Sabbath.
I have heard different things about who. I will say I have heard different things about who wrote what on that show, but I've never heard. I never heard that.
As much as I've toured with Tracy, I didn't know that.
Yeah, as much as she toured with Tracy.
I did not know that.
You work in 30 Rock, so you probably have information that we don't have.
Could it possibly be slightly incorrect? Or
no.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Okay, because we got some people here.
You're saying two different things, Questlove.
Well, because y'all telling me two different things. Anyway,
you 100. Okay,
tell us what happens in the writers' room. No.
I tend to listen to a woman who worked with the man. Who, if he's never said that, then
okay. But I think industry wide, we call it the writers' room for a reason, right? Like everybody usually gets a script, but all those scripts go back into the writers' room, and usually everybody contributes to it. So. Okay. You know, and every show is different. So, like, there might be some shows where, like, if you do the first draft, most of what's in there is you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, on most of the shows I've written on, like, the person who gets the script credit, like, it's a little bit, it's the room's project. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because everybody has the task of doing it. And it's actually interesting because it's very different at Jimmy Fallon, because as you know, we were there, like the writers really
variety shows are done differently.
Very different. You have to take a lot of ownership of your bits. SNL is the same way. So like Dial and I used to write Slow Jam, and like they weren't like a couple other times other writers wrote it. Mm-hmm. For the most part, it was like, y'all go write that. Yeah. But when you get into a writer room on a narrative show, it really is the power dynamic changes, the who writing what changes, what voices change, who's writing for what characters changes. It depends on how the showrunners run
the
room.
By the way, that's the irony, is that, you know, on variety shows, all the writers are in the credits at the end, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On these other shows, and by the way, it might just be one person who wrote that sketch. The opposite is true on a regular show, when in fact it's sort of like the truth is the opposite. Because on a variety show, like one person might have written the sketch, everybody gets the credit. Regular show, one person gets the credit, everybody wrote the script.
One of the questions I have is, when a show is established, at the beginning of the season, is there an overall arc that you guys have to follow? Like, in other words, if, say, Ange and Diallo are designated to write episode 6, and you're in a room together, and you have to decide what's going to happen in that episode. Like, what if you just decide that, okay, I'm gonna shoot this character off, or this person's gonna break their leg in this episode, and then, like, how is an arc carried out, and what creative freedoms are you allowed to bring to your episode?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a serialized episode, I mean, if things track over, if you're following stories over different episodes, no one writer, you follow what happens. What happens is you track. I'm better at writing than holding things in my hand. What happens is you track what's going to happen each individual episode before you start assigning episodes to individual writers. So what happens is you might get the episode as a writer that kills off the favorite character. You can't say, no, I don't want to do that. Right. You know, that's just what happens.
Oh, that happened many times. we would go in the room. You work it all out. You know, we work it all out. We know the jokes. We know the direction. We know how the character's tracking, what their emotions are, where they're going. And I've actually tried to go off script and tried to, like, put my own thing in there, and, you know, no, that's a no-no. And I'm a staff writer, so these guys are all way ahead of me, right? So as a staff writer, they're like, no, Tracy, you need to follow what was in that room and track it. I'm like, yeah, but I felt like when I was writing this that Tracy would actually say this. And they're like, no, you got to stay on track, stay on course, because if you go off, the rest of the show is now off.
I think in a lot of situations, though, in the best version of this, it's a lot of discussion. So, and it really depends on the tone set by the showrunner, whoever's really the boss in the room, who's the Kenya Barris in the room. That's right. Because that person, if they're really great at their job, they're entertaining all these ideas. So if Tracy comes and says, hey, I want to kill off this character, it's a discussion. It's not like a no. And they might be like, you know what, that's dope. Or like if Tracy comes and says, like, I feel such an affinity toward Tiffany Haddish's character. This episode where she goes and visits her mother, like, I should write that one because I feel strongly about that one. I want to put something special on that one. If the show is functioning the way it's supposed to, that tends to be listened to. Mm-hmm. And you tend to let people do what they're good at, especially with a first pass.
That is true. Even with the characters, though, like the show I'm on, The Neighborhood, it's about, you know, a white family that moves into an all-black neighborhood, I believe, in Pasadena. And
is that a CBS show?
CBS show.
Is that Cedric the Entertainer?
Cedric the Entertainer. That's
correct.
We got
a black poster.
We got a black
poster. That's a big deal. And it's a big deal.
Tell us what it's about.
With Tashina Arnold.
CBS doesn't do that. So tell us about it.
It's a really big deal. And they are extremely excited about it. And we literally, I don't want to give too much away, but in the room, it's split. Half and half, half white, half black. And it's interesting to hear the things that we are learning about each other that we're putting in the show. One little thing I'll tell you, we talked about washcloths.
Oh, yes. And how white people don't use them.
Thank you. Yeah. Did not know that.
Yeah, white folk don't use washcloths.
Brought it up in the room, and one of the writers was like, what?
They use their hands? What they
she
do?
Goes, what, yeah, do you, what do you do with that? I go, you wash.
Yeah.
No washcloths. Yeah.
What do you do, like the Safeguard commercial where you just wash with the soap?
My bar of soap is my bar of soap.
No.
And so, you know.
Yeah. This was how the room was. Each side could not believe.
You know, you don't get in your crevices like that. Like, you're not scraping any dead skin. You're just really on the surface. And if you're using Dove, you're really not getting anything.
Girl. This was the discussion. This was the discussion, right? This is not what this episode. The episode is not about that.
It don't. You know? You need you some peppermint soap, and you need you a loofah, and you need it now, Steve.
Some Dr. Bronner.
You will learn so. There is nothing that is off limits. When you introduce your wife or husband, you got to warn them, like, people in the room might know a little bit about you. Or you tell the room, like, when I introduce my significant other, don't tell them what I said about her underwear. They will know everything about you. Mm.
So I was going to say, similar to what Jimmy said the first year of doing the Tonight Show, was that everything in your life will be introduced in the writer's room. That is true?
Oh, my God. Yeah, something about the story you told about how your mother-in-law gave you the Cracker Barrel jacket.
Oh, yeah.
That's right, because your husband is...
My husband is white.
Yes.
Yes, can I say that here?
Yes.
Wait, what if we were like, no?
We got to ask Laia.
Is that say that here. Right.
Is that all right, Laia? I understand the struggle.
Fonte, come back.
We're good. We understand each other.
Come back, Fonte. Wait, I walked out the room.
No, my mother-in-law bought me for Christmas 1 year a blouse. Excuse me?
Your husband's really white.
Yeah, he is. Okay. He's white. Why? What? I don't
what? It's called a follow-up joke. What? Yeah. follow up.
But she bought me a blouse from Cracker Barrel. And
Cracker Barrel sells blouses?
Yes, exactly. And that's, I was like, it blew my mind. I'm like, are you for real? And that hurt her feelings, right? Ooh. So yeah, I'm the asshole for doing that in the family. I'm the asshole in the family. So then after the holidays, she came up to me. She's like, Tracy, I'm so sorry about that blouse I bought you from Cracker Barrel. I said, why? She said, I did not know Cracker Barrel didn't serve black people back in the 60s and the 70s.
Really? Yeah.
And I was like, that's the reason why. But she did research. Yeah, like to
figure out. That's how they greeted you at Cracker Barrel. They're like, oh, nigga. No, you think you're about to get some grace?
Bro.
Take a blouse and leave.
Cracker Barrel is eponymously titled.
Seriously.
Yes. Yes. How about that?
I'm like, who the fuck is buying antebellum blouses out of Cracker Barrel?
I couldn't believe it.
By the way, we went to the Super Bowl in Indiana one year. We were at Fallon.
Yeah.
And we ate at Cracker Barrel. I had never had Cracker Barrel. It was the first time I ever had Cracker Barrel. And I was like, I don't know why people are fighting to eat this shit.
Wait.
It is pretty good.
This news to me.
They got clothing lines.
It's pretty good.
Side note,
yeah.
I believe that.
They got a record label.
Yeah, they got a record label.
No.
Who was on our show that?
Kenny Rogers.
Kenny Rogers was on our show, he was on Cracker Barrel label, and they gave us mad swag.
They have a lot of money.
Wow.
Wait, here's the weird shit, though.
Swag.
When Jazzy Jeff got married.
Okay.
You know.
Cracker Barrel, they catered it? Like,
listen, Will's gift to Jeff was the wedding was in Jamaica.
Cracker Barrel.
So he had them come down and cater and
that's
Jeff's favorite spot.
That's not
I am officially protesting Hidden Beach. Yeah. Right. I don't want my money going to that.
I'm burning my copy of Who is Jill Scott right now.
Exactly.
That's hysterical.
Shout out to Lynette. I know she wasn't digging that. Compromises, boo.
Compromises.
It was her wedding.
That's why I said compromises.
Yeah. Damn, I didn't know that. I never ate a Cracker Barrel, so I didn't know.
So what did you do with the blouse? What did you end up doing with it?
She felt so bad about it. She took it back. Okay. She felt so bad about the blouse, and I felt bad, but I just couldn't believe like she really gave and she told me nobody usually tells you when they give you a Christmas gift. And I got that from. She's like, I got it from Cracker Barrel. She was really proud.
Yeah, she was bragging.
So at
on
first
it.
I'm like, is she trying to say something? Or you know, like what, you know?
where is she from?
Indiana. Indiana.
Where in Indiana?
Maryville, Indiana, right next to Gary, Indiana, and also next to Chicago, right next to Chicago.
MV.
They don't know. Mm-mm. They don't show.
Mm-mm.
You don't care about what's going on. What's going on in Maryville?
It's messed up, man.
It is messed up.
Ah, okay. So what else happens in a writer novel?
We're talking about
lots of therapy.
Well, can I ask? Yes. Can I without
physical fights?
Physical. Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
Without opening up any Pandora's boxes for your your jobs.
No barrel of crackers.
Was the exodus of the initial writers of season one? Were they okay with not? No one's okay with getting fired, but
aren't they white? They got jobs now, right?
I really don't know any of the ones. I don't know them.
They work at
Cracker Barrel. Diallo and Bashir doing all right.
No,
I think in our case, like we always knew that we wanted to come on for one season, but we had another show. We had a show at Comedy Central that was, you know, something that we had created.
Southside.
There you go. Yeah. Southside. About the Southside.
We just
Chicago.
Got back from Chicago, by the way, like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
So for us, it was more of a timing thing.
It's incredible.
Like, we couldn't do season two of Last OG and do our own show.
We went
to Jordan. We were like, look, we got a Comedy Central show. He's like, I know what that's about. Go forth.
Well, I meant more from the standpoint of maybe the white writers that were replaced with more black writers.
Look, I think that with that show, I don't know who listens to the podcast. Maybe they do. I think it's safe to say. No, I'm saying these particular writers. I think it's safe to say that at some point somebody pulled them aside and was like, "Look, you know, Tracy doesn't necessarily feel like you have the voice of the show."
But you know, also
Pat,
most TV,
we're gonna find somebody else.
You know, this happened in Fallon. Every TV show, the first couple years is figuring out who actually belongs on staff. Like The Simpsons. You know, my favorite show. Seasons 3 through 8, you know, there's a reason that season 3 through 8 are the seasons that I always say are the best seasons, because those first, they're like figuring out like, oh, and then, you know, Conan shows up, and then some other, you know, Al Jean shows up, and then they figure out like, all right, these are the voices that's really going to take us to the Oakley and Weinstein show up.
So yeah, it takes time. I watched like the first season of Last OG, and I even told Angie, like, I thought it was, I liked the show, but to me it just didn't seem to have a tone. Like, it would have like these really supposedly comic moments and then like these really dark moments.
Okay, well, that part was intentional. Just, and let me just say this, because we, in one of our conversations with Tracy, I'll never forget, he said, like, one thing that he liked about Donald, he actually did say, like, you know, Donald used to write for me, and now he's got his show that I feel like is poignant but funny and does its thing. And he was like, I want this show to be you laugh in 1 minute, you cry in the next. So that was by design.
I will also say about white writers that are writing for black shows, it's amazing to me how all the white shows I've been on, most of the time I've been the only black writer. But whenever on a black show, there's always a ton of white writers. But I will say that a lot of times when white writers come into a black room, it's a shock for them that they don't know everything about the culture. If you're writing about black people in Brooklyn, don't assume that it's going to be like writing for Maud or whatever the hell you used to write on. You know, like right. study.
Shout
up
out to
on,
Maud.
You know what I'm saying?
Who is that writer?
Greatest theme song.
Study up on that. Like, it's like if you were writing a doctor's thing, go talk to some doctors. But I'm amazed at how many white writers do come into a room and it's like, well, I don't have any black friends, but I'm here. You know, so that's.
I mean, you said that was John Amos's thing back in the 70s, right? Really? Like. He was just like, I can't believe this is the writer's room on my show, but yeah. I'm going to push back as much as possible. Then they killed him.
Yeah.
Well, that was yeah.
Yeah.
Killed
him. Well, that was, he left. Yeah, I forget.
Well, that was Esther Roll's show. I mean, really, she was the real.
He was like, I'm tired center. Of JJ. I'm
Let's talk about that character. After this.
She was the one who decided.
Oh, God. I'm dividing by chapters.
Anytime you're at the mathana.
Have we decided what all the lyrics are?
Keep your head above water. Making a way when you can.
It's the Chow Line song. It's the Chow Line.
Temporary layoffs. Easy credit ripoffs.
Easy credit ripoffs.
Wait, who wrote this? Is this Quincy Jones?
Stretching and surviving. Hanging in the Chow Line.
Hanging in the jiving.
Ain't we lucky we got him?
I think it's standing in the chow line. Yeah.
Hanging in the chow line.
Hanging in the chow line.
Hanging in the chow line.
Shout out, Chappelle.
What the fuck did the chow line look like in the 70s?
Soup line.
Oh, straight I'm like, sorry, like wait. Soup kitchen.
Who wrote this? Who wrote
that
song?
A lot of men there.
Jim Gilstrap and Binky Williams.
Jim Gilstrap, Binky Williams.
What else
did
they write that we wouldn't like?
He played guitar on You Are the Sunshine of My Life.
Right? Binky, that's Pink Dog Band, right?
Yeah, Jim Gilstrap, he's a guitar player. You know what?
By the way, what a great gig.
No, I think that's him singing the first verse of You Are the Sunshine of My Life.
It is. Yes,
Jim Gilstrap.
By the way, what a great gig. That theme song, they probably have mansions on top of boats on top of mansions.
Yeah, but what they doing now? Because we ain't got no theme songs.
They have mansions on top of boats.
What about someone whose dream was to write a theme song and they grew up and now we ain't got
nothing?
Came along too late. That's over with. That's over with.
It's sold for advertising.
Why don't we have theme songs?
It's advertising.
Because nobody is
talking about this today. We're talking about this today. Go.
I watch a lot of Cheers. It's on Netflix.
Yes, yes.
And it's funny because I remember when this happened in real life, and then on Netflix, it's funny to see that show had like a minute and a half damn theme song, and then halfway they were like, you know what, this is too much time to be wasting. And then it came all the way down. They cut the whole middle out. It's really about space and content. You're fighting against commercials, and you're fighting against a B storyline, which you really need to give the A storyline air. So there's just no room. And so to be like, and then we're going to lose more space, a minute and a half, to some singing that has nothing to do with the plot.
I mean, I miss the outro themes they used to have, like.
That happens, like, right.
That's a long start. That'll never happen again.
That happened to us on Scrubs. You used to say, it started off, we had a whole song like, I'm no Superman, and by the seventh season, it'll be just, man. Yeah.
Wait, so can I ask the room a question then? What was, to your recollection, what was the first sitcom that caught you?
Family Ties.
What?
Yeah, for me, yeah. In fact, I started wearing a tie and carrying
like
a briefcase to school. Yeah. Yeah, it kept me on the straight and narrow.
My favorite episode was My Name is Alex P. Keaton.
Was that the one where he does the 30-minute speech?
Yeah, where he went to therapy.
By the way, has not aged well.
Really?
Yeah, I read a whole post about it, and they like posted some clips. Like, it's super self-serious.
I don't think any of that shit is aged well.
It was good, but it's
Cheers is aged great.
It's over the top.
Is, well, okay.
Wait,
because
can I get my answer for all my questions? Wait, hold on. I want to know, because I know Diallo answered, but Bashir, Tracy.
When you said the first show that caught you, do you mind if I ask you, what do you mean by that?
Like, exactly. As a kid, to your recollection, what was the first sitcom that you were like, you sat, you laughed, you was like, this is the shit.
I didn't talk like that when I was there.
This is the bomb.
I preferred.
This is bumping.
Probably. Well, I think probably the Cosby Show, actually. The only thing about that show is I did not like that show growing up because my family was not like that, and I felt very much cheated. I was like, what the fuck? This ain't shit like the South Side of Chicago. But I recognized, even when I would laugh in spite of myself, so I recognized how great it was, but I was also like, this is Dr. Lawyer in the house and shit. They know
where that happened.
Crackheads outside. This is wonderful.
And in Brooklyn.
And they've been the real, I didn't know Brooklyn had parts like that.
I'll say mine was definitely Good Times.
Good Times.
I love Good Times. Mm-hmm. That was the show. I remember thinking, God, every episode they gotta get rent. Every episode.
That writer's room had to be great.
I was like,
that is so funny.
Think about it. They had to do every episode. They needed to pay rent. And what did they do? A talent show.
A talent
they
show.
They always had every some episode? Talent show. Well, you know, a lot of them. A lot
was
of them.
Happening.
Michael
was
seeing you and I. Well, you know, right? That was at the wedding. Well,
when you're
wedding.
When you're young and in love.
When you're young and in love.
I was watching that show recently because it's on MeTV, which I watch when I go to my mom's house. And MeTV is like
it's called
it's like,
Memorable Entertainment Television. But it's really excuse to shows from the '70s.
But I just want to say that I didn't realize how much because it was every single episode they have like a terrible crisis that they lose.
Yeah,
kids falling down there.
Every
the
episode
kids fall down the elevator.
Oh god,
kids getting burned over.
It's horrible.
Irons.
You know that the Cosby Show got rejected a bunch of different places when
because
he was taking
of that,
it
right?
Because he would not. Every network was like, but you got to put him in the ghetto, and he was like, no, my black family is going to be in a very wealthy. They were all like, well, just do it in Harlem. He's like, no, we're going to do Brooklyn. Like,
make him a janitor. Make her a school teacher.
Way. Wow.
I did not know
no
that.
No one's
wow.
going to choose me. Like, they're drugging these like, white women.
Nobody's going to relate. So eventually he drugged Brandon Tartikoff.
I gotta admit, I fell off the bandwagon and watched my first Cosby episode day before yesterday.
We watched it together and we had it.
I got a little.
The show is great.
Right. I never quite stopped watching the
Fuck
Cosby
no.
Show.
Well, yeah.
It wasn't that I was protesting. I just didn't know that it was on TV One.
It's on TV One. And it was coming on Bounce, I think.
So the syndication never actually stopped, did it?
No.
Black
syndication,
not really. Not really.
But it's not on iTunes anymore.
It was supposed to stop.
Or,
there was supposed to be a
we
moment.
We hit the reruns on black television.
All the streaming.
Black TV was like, fuck that.
I can't get it on iTunes anymore.
It's on Netflix. What are you going
to
say,
Ash? Man, nobody gave a shout out to What's Happening. I'm the only one who wanted to be D.
Is that what your shit?
Yeah. Well, besides watching the Jefferson and being like, these kids ain't mixed.
That's hilarious.
Hollywood still has a big problem with casting mixed people.
They still can't do it right.
And you feel some type of way. Like, I don't feel
that. That's it. Hilarious.
We had Michael McDonald on the show, and he was breaking down the
Doobie Brothers.
Doobie Brothers.
Dunbar. Classic.
Yes. Al
That's
Dunbar.
My favorite Classic, episode. Yes.
Of
What's Happening?
What's Happening.
At your Al Dunbar. Like, man, I love that.
That's when the Doobie Brothers had, like, the cafe or whatever, right?
The bootleg.
They were performing, and yeah.
I remember that episode.
Yeah, that was the one for me.
I feel like back then we gave permission for things that just didn't really, when you think about it, when Rerun dropped the recorder,
yeah.
It was literally like right in front of Rerun.
Like the whole auditorium, smooth criminal leaned, you know, right in Rerun's direction.
We always talk, that's another thing we do in the writers, and we always talk about how easy it must have been back in the day. Just be like, all right, we just want to get some people stranded on an island.
Right.
That was supposed to be a one season show.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And
it was
too big a hit. Yeah.
Right. That was supposed to be a one season show.
We talk about how much money people used to make in writer rooms. Because, you know, every writer I know nowadays has 15 jobs if you have any kind of talent.
I mean, the star of the show, season 5, will have an apartment. Like,
for real.
Like, the money is not the same.
Let me say, if you were a writer on Cheers for, like, 4 seasons, you are straight.
You're good forever.
So is the goal
you don't need money for
Tracy
a minute.
Tracy got
to
get to her call girl appointment after this.
I'm putting my business out, bitch.
Real shit.
She's not the only one.
I'm like,
sunset. This would be easy. Oh, that's really convenient.
There's a reason I was late.
I'm heading right to West Hollywood, girl.
Some gas money, goddamn.
Can I ask the profession that the four of you are in? Is there an instant pressure to always come up with a line? Like when you're dealing, I'm treating this like porno. Like when you're dealing with civilians. Like just regular people that don't work on your show, do you have to hold yourself back from always saying the joke?
Ange don't.
Like, Ange is always, but that's the thing. As long, I've known Ange for so long, and you always have the punchline, like, ready. And it's.
And I wasted so many.
No, but I meant, like, in your, can you ever just relax and not go for the punchline?
Catch us at hour 12 in the writer's room.
Yeah, I mean, even in Fallon, like that writer room, I wouldn't describe it as like a happy room with like joyfulness and joy.
Well, no. I meant the punchline as in you're always humorous. Because I visited,
Men. Chuck Lorre?
Two and a Half Men.
What's the name of the show?
Oh, right. Two and a Half Men, yeah.
So
yeah.
I visited the set of Two and a Half Men, and it was during a break, and I saw something that just blew my mind. Like, I guess the director stood in the center, and then all of his writers was in a circle.
That's what we do.
And he's like, all right, I need someone to go.
That's what we do.
No, go.
That's what, yep.
No, that's not really? Funny. Go,
yep.
Go.
That was Tuesday night for me, this past Tuesday.
Yeah, we still do
and by that. The way, that definitely happens more on multi. Like, on, I was on Marlon. Whenever we would call break, Marlon would, like, sit somewhere on set, and then, like, all these people who weren't even, I mean, like, some of them were writers and some of them were just Wayanses. Like, they would converge around him and then he'd come out with like 20 new jokes.
But that happens on single cameras too. I mean, I've never been on a single camera where you weren't shooting a scene and then they were like, all right, well, can we do some different jokes in this scene?
Yeah. But so, is there a pressure? Because just the way that the director is treating them, it's like, if you came with a, no.
Yeah.
Really? Next.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, some writers really perform in those environments. Mm-hmm. Like, some people, you're like, oh, that dude's a killer. Yeah. You know, oh, she's always got a punchline ready to go, like a good one.
Yeah, I love that. That actually gets me going because it's where that happened Tuesday night. That happens every Tuesday night. When we tape, you got to be ready. Yeah. And a line that we thought in the room was going to hit didn't hit. Showrunners turn it around. Okay. Be thinking about this line, and all of us are thinking.
You should be thinking about that when you're watching it, too, right? The writers should be watching that, being like, all right, we definitely have to punch up these five lines
That's right.
before he comes over here or she comes over here and asks.
Do you sometimes question the intelligence of the target audience of the show? In other words, the writers, you guys might be Harvard material. Oh, you guys
I think that's a terrible excuse. Like, if you're like, oh, well, they're just not smart enough to get it.
I've heard it said a lot,
on certain TV shows.
Yep.
But but it's never the truth. Like,
it's all the quotes of certain TV shows.
Not having, to me, like, not having faith in the audience is not having faith in the art. Like, it's insecurity. Like, if you can be funny, then motherfuckers will get it.
Yeah, it's interesting, but then you see the Nielsen ratings come back, and then the network.
Baby die.
People don't understand that sometimes what we write, we'll want it to be a certain. We'll write a certain thing, and then by the time it goes through a studio, a network, and then they'll say, "Oh, we can't say that because we have advertisers." That, you know, it'll come out and it'll be five times watered down.
So even you brought that up. Yeah. Who has a Nielsen box? I've never in my all
they
my
still
life.
Count.
I don't know nobody.
I have no idea. I've never gotten
like,
one.
Not a Nielsen box, but we used to have to do the journals and stuff.
We did.
Knew
those
you knew
somebody.
Oh, Black Your family
Midwest.
Was allowed
it's
to
always
have
somebody.
We
in the
did
Midwest.
One of those too. My mom made us write down every Black TV show, but the whole thing is we sent
like
them in late,
magazine.
So it didn't count.
Oh my god!
Oh no! You should have been late. Oh,
I know.
Damn!
I was sitting there writing two.
The episode of That's My Mama was great. It's like 1989. You're like, damn.
I'm kidding. My mom had us looking through TV Guide like 227.
Even if you didn't watch it.
I was always lying on mine because, you know, couldn't write down that I was watching Real Sex at 10 o'clock on Friday.
Scrambled.
They're like, Real Sex has a 0.1 again. What's going on?
Are Nielsen still used now? Or
yes.
Yeah, everything is used. Yeah.
Have they figured out a way to figure in
is it
streaming?
They have Live Plus. They have Live. Live plus 3, Live plus 5, and then Live plus 7.
What's Live plus 3 info? What's the difference?
That's the number of days it took for people to watch it when it was sitting on their
DVR.
DVR.
Oh, wow.
So it's built into our cable. So,
But they don't measure after Live plus 7, interestingly enough, because advertisers don't care if you're watching it 12 days later. Like, they want you to go see, you know, Rampage this week at the movies. You know what I'm saying? So
I was at a meeting and I found out that they're even, Nielsen ratings are also using, like, Instagram. Like, they're even using the streaming. They said that just started last year.
Well, engagement is another way they measure. Like, there are TV shows that get terrible ratings, but they are in season 6 because they're always being written about, and they have huge people online.
They might win an Emmy.
Ride or die for them online, and people are like, we tweet about it crazily. They want to talk about it. So you're like, this other show that I like has way more ratings, but is going away because people aren't talking about
it. Then they'll wonder why they had seven characters killed off of that show so they could keep affording the budget since they're not getting the ratings. Then people be like, damn it, you ruined my show. Well, we had to keep, you know, the budget down.
Do you guys feel the pressure to keep like a social media situation and be present?
I don't. But
yeah, you like your life goals. You don't have no, you don't got no Instagram.
Nah, I don't
nothing.
Fuck with social media. Oh, period.
Man. Damn, yeah. How you do that?
That's
you
so minute. Jealous.
Yo, how you, I want that life.
Yeah, yes. What's that life?
You never had a Twitter?
I used to have everything. I just got rid of it all. I had everything.
What made you everything. Just say fuck it?
Why?
I'll be honest. I heard Kendrick Lamar talking on the radio.
Okay.
And what's the one that came out before?
Pimp a Butterfly?
The one right before that.
Good Kid, Mad City?
Good Kid, Mad City. When Good Kid, Mad City came out, he was on the radio, and he was just talking about how, like, he had this epiphany that, like, he's like, every minute that I'm, like, on social media is a minute that I'm not working on my art. And he's like, I got to stop doing that. And I thought to myself, because I wasn't where I wanted to be in my life at the time, and I was like, this young man is on to something.
Now, I will say, check back in with Bashir a year from now and see if he's still no social media.
How did you two meet? Because you're kind of like college. Ernie and Bert in my head.
Thank you.
I appreciate being Ernie.
What school did you guys go to?
Went to Harvard.
You're not Ernie.
We met. I do love pigeons.
I feel like you're Bert.
I do love pigeons.
And oatmeal.
I have a 16-month-year-old now, so I watch a lot more Sesame Street than I used to. And I'm like, oh, so John Legend singing with the Muppets now. This is all right. This is okay.
Has it aged well?
We met an acapella group called Brothers, because that was the best name on the planet.
The best name the smart black kids at Harvard could come up with.
And we all wore maroon vests, and we sang like Boys to Men.
It was a disaster.
How many of y'all was it?
In Brothers?
There were five of us.
No. It was like 11.
No. There was a core five.
Here's the thing.
We were like Wu-Tang.
Here's why he's saying that, because there was like 11 members, but like only five would show up to the gigs.
Okay.
Because be like, nobody gave a shit.
Only you guys here again.
Oh, damn.
Nobody give a shit about Brothers.
You're our alto tonight.
All right, man, you got to sing Man Oh Man for the fucking Man Oh Back Man. Bay Fish Company. Man,
and were y'all English majors?
Not by the impressions. What?
Y'all English majors? Or was I it majored something in, so less
he
obvious?
He was pre-med.
I was pre-med.
Okay. I'm from the hood, and I went to Harvard.
So my parents wasn't trying to... I'm from the hood. I went to Harvard. My parents weren't trying to hear me be like, I'm going to be an actor.
Yep.
So I had to pretend I was pre-med for like
years. I was an econ major. You know, I thought I was going to Wall Street. And
and both of y'all graduated.
Hell yeah, y'all both graduated. Hey, and to this day, people are like, "Hey man, you went to Harvard. Oh man, you gotta be a millionaire." And it's like, "Hey, get in there, man." People are like, "All right."
But can I say something really? That my personal opinion is, if you're an artist, I really feel like college is like might be a terrible decision.
I agree.
I know a lot of people.
I agree.
I won't name them at Harvard who I think would be really big right now in society as artists, but they just decided to go to class instead of saying fuck that, let me go get this hustle.
It's a lot of parents like that's college, listening. Like, please, motherfucker, seriously.
That's my two cents. I mean, people feel differently.
Your parents life lessons.
If you are a musician, what the fuck are you doing in college?
Yeah, okay, I don't want my kids to listen money, to this. Yeah,
like, what about managing your money?
Like, community college, take some courses. Yeah,
you got to learn that in life.
They don't actually teach that at Harvard.
Accounting, marketing.
They don't teach accounting at Harvard.
They don't teach that. Yes,
but you need a backup. You need
personal finances.
What is
personal
finance? The backup. Thank you, Tracy.
What my mama told me was I always wanted to be a comedian. She said, baby, you need to go to school. You know to go to college. And I'm from the South, so I went to a community college for 2 years, Miami-Dade Community College.
All right.
And then you from Miami?
I grew up in Miami, Opa-locka in the hood. Anyway. Opa-locka.
You know
Opa-locka.
I know Opa-locka. I used to go to Central High School. Waka-flocka, too.
Okay.
I know Miami.
So, yeah, I went to Miami-Dade for 2 years, and then I was on the speech and debate team, and that's how I knew I would get out of Miami. I wanted out of Miami back then. It was so bad back then. And so I got a scholarship to a college in Ohio, never been to the Midwest, Heidelberg University.
I thought you were going to say Miami of Ohio.
I was going to go there. But the speech coach, he was at Eastern Michigan University. Mm-hmm. So I went and got in there, and then he quit. And he said, if you come with me, I'll get you a full ride. So I went with him, and I got a full ride.
That's why you sound
the way you sound.
Because one of the things that I think about all the time, we talk about the pressure, you could get fired from a writing job at any time. I've gone years without work. And mm-hmm. I'm like, I went to University of Pennsylvania. I have a medical anthropology. I know how to do shit except write.
Is that what you got, Ange?
Yeah.
Medical anthropology.
I forgot you went to UPenn.
Smart
ass. Talk about it.
Ivy League.
Like, literally. Wow. I'm like, I don't know how. I can't even do my own taxes at this point. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I didn't learn any.
But you know what's eye-opening is to that point is the number of people who I went to college with to this day who will be like, Diallo probably gets more than I do because he's more engaged, like reaching out and be like, hey, man, that writing shit seems to be going well. So, like, how does one get into that? I'm like, that's you did recruiting when you was 25. When I came to LA and starved, you was recruiting and you had a job at Goldman. So I don't know what to tell you at this point. You know, go back in time and work 20 years.
All right, let's take a break.
Well, we're moving on now.
Shout outs and rest in peace to Alan Thick.
Alan Thick didn't write this.
He didn't write this.
Did he?
He wrote Different Strokes, man.
He wrote this one too.
No, both of them.
I'm looking it up.
He got Different
Waters
Strokes money.
And Jeanette Dubois.
$5.
Yeah, Jeanette Dubois.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
look it up. I mean, but
who wrote this one?
Jeanette Dubois and Orrin Waters.
Jeanette Dubois wrote Good for
That's
her
singing. That's her singing.
But
it's okay because on this show
black and wrong.
It was Jeanette Dubois and Jeff Berry that wrote it.
I could be wrong.
This is a long ass theme.
I mean, they were burning through minutes of content time.
they're like,
okay, the script is 8 pages, y'all. We got to make some cuts.
Technically, it's only 41 seconds, but you know.
That's a long time.
So,
by the way, can I just say?
Not as long
can I just
as power.
Say you were playing Barney Miller earlier, so I had to look it up. Hal Linden, still alive.
Yeah.
Really?
He is. Yeah, I figured. I was like, that
I thought he was out of
has
here.
To be out of here. He's 87.
You just jinxed that.
Yeah, here's something I did not know about the Jefferson theme song.
Hal is like, no, death has forgotten me.
The co-writer of the Jefferson theme song also wrote River Deep, Mountain High.
Really?
Oh, wow. The Do Run
Tina,
Run.
The Tina Turner song, right?
Then He Kissed Me.
Who?
Jeff Berry.
I thought you were going into a
personal story.
Getting paid. Getting paid. Makes sense.
All right, so Bashir and Diallo, would you mind sharing with us the experience of trying to develop a show?
For HBO.
Yeah, the whole experience of Brothers in Atlanta.
Oh, man, shout out Brothers in Atlanta.
Damn, y'all just looked at the floor like y'all wanted to pour some liquor on the ground.
Pour some liquor.
I mean, it's like losing one of your children. You know what I'm
really
saying?
Was.
And by the way, we did two pilots for place in 4 years and 2 months. So that was 4 years and 2 months
can
of
I
your
see
life.
These?
And acted on shows on HBO,
of
too.
Of course you can't.
We didn't do that, too.
Okay.
We definitely don't have
you won't look
any
in,
of it.
You did look
I'm in. Sorry.
Because that would be illegal.
Okay.
Thank I'm so you. I will say that I'm so proud of Brothers in Atlanta. It's so fucking funny. Fonte is in it. It's just, it's
but
just,
it's still
it's
funny.
So
funny.
What's the process
that's
of
hilarious.
Trying to start a car that?
Well, I will say HBO's process I think is evolving, but it's typically a longer process. We were there developing for 2 years, which is on the minimum side. There are other people there who've been developing for up to 6 years.
Well, there was also that one project that was there for 8 years.
Eight years of development, which is I think a testament to their sense over there that everything needs to be slowed down to the point where we can examine it a lot to make sure it's great. Sometimes that works. We see some of the shows, obviously, like Game of Thrones are incredible. Sometimes that process that they have leads to, I think,
we were
mistakes.
Also there during a period of great executive turnover. Like, we were there for three different presidents of the network. So when we arrived, there was one person who was president. She was a big champion. We did a pilot there called The Reporters, which I think conceptually is still one of the best things we've ever
done.
Yeah,
so, okay, yeah, because I never
literally
saw that one. What was
that
the
best thing
one?
In the world? It's about these two black reporters.
We took all the president's men.
Okay.
And we put ourselves in the roles of those reporters. And I don't think it's any industry secret anymore. The concept of the show was essentially that every conspiracy theory that black people believe in, we were on the hunt to find out if it was true or not. And the joke of the series was,
give me an example.
Is Tupac alive?
Okay.
Okay.
Every episode was us examining a different sort of, like, you know, because One of them actually came out of Fallon.
That's
interesting
right.
enough.
The original one is. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it was the search for James Brown's gold. So when Eddie came on, when Eddie Murphy came on Jimmy Fallon,
right.
He said that, like, you know, he was blowing up as a young comedian, and he met James Brown, and James Brown was like, Eddie, you're doing so good, man. You know, but don't put your money in no bank. And he was like, well, what should I do with the money? And he was like, do what I do. Hey, man, bury that shit in the woods.
Wow.
And Eddie was like, well, what if you forget where you buried it? He's like, hey, at least the government won't get it. So we were sitting at our desk at Fallon, and we were like, what if somewhere in Augusta, Georgia, in the woods, there's like tons of hidden treasure. So our characters would just go in search of all that stuff. It was a really sort of unique concept for a show. We also came at a time when like Girls was really starting to take off for HBO. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they steered us in a way more like Girlsian, let's do a very grounded
show.
Yeah,
I mean, what I'm learning, because we're now Comedy Central with Southside, and it's like night and day, it really comes down to support. We just had a support. Like, yeah. We didn't have the support. You have to have the support of the person at the top. And eventually the person at the top changed, and they supported other shit, and we were still there. We were like, uh-oh.
Well, that president, just to finish the story, that president left, new president comes on, he's like, hey, I love you guys. I don't like the pilot you did for her. Do a pilot for me. So that was another 2 years of our lives.
That was the Brothers in Atlanta.
That takes that long to develop.
It doesn't have to.
But that's the HBO process then. I don't know what the process is now.
Well, it's going to change because they got to put out like 10 times more content now.
We shot a great pilot with Fonte, as he said, and Jaden Smith and Maya Rudolph.
Yeah. I saw it.
And Big Boy from Outkast, and it was a great pilot. It was all about being in Atlanta. Actually, at one point, Donald was going to be in our show. At another point, he was like, hey, after I come off tour, I'm going to do my own Atlanta show. We're also big fans of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I think, like, the same way there are a million white shows that take place in New York and L.A., you can have more than one black show that takes place in Atlanta.
I will say one thing that was difficult and frustrating for me was, you know, back in 2012, Diallo was telling the network, like, hey, Atlanta, my hometown, I'm from there. We got to do a show in Atlanta. And they just, you should see the blank stares we would get in meetings. And to the point where we had to wait till 2015 where GQ published an article saying, hey, Atlanta is a city where, like, music is important. And then we had to, like, walk that into President of HBO's office. Like, see, we've been saying for 3 years, like, this is a real thing.
Well,
and
now
it was frustrating not being able to convey that.
We had to wait for Columbus to discover Atlanta before they would let us shoot a show.
And then they were like, hey, guys, Atlanta's a good idea.
So now how do they feel with the success of the other Atlanta, like?
I don't talk to them.
Have you had I just told you so, or, like?
No, man, we haven't had time to say I told you so. I will say that, you know, I'm happy for anybody black who gets to create a show. So like people ask me about other black shows, and even if I don't love those shows, I'll generally be like, I love it, because it is so hard to get an idea that is pure through the crucible.
It's so hard to get that
through
the pit and the champion.
So you're telling me just because a show was greenlit. Does not mean.
Hell no.
Oh, yeah. So Brothers in Atlanta. So this is the end of the story.
Nigga.
So Brothers in Atlanta, we shot the pilot, and it went to series, and we hired a room full of writers, and we wrote the entire first season. And then we were like, okay, so what are our production dates? So they're like, we'll get back to you. And we'll get back to you stretched out for 6 months of our lives, and we're out here in L.A. like just waiting. And then they called us one day, The new person was like, I think we're going in a different direction. So
I'm curious, who was the sounding board?
What do you mean?
Who was the judge and the jury with the hands on the guillotine to whether, you know?
Oh, it's the president. It's the people at the top. But, you know, those decisions are made by the people who work in the building who are in competition with each other. So if we've been there for 4 years and somebody's coming in with something that's new and hot and they like, and there's only so much airtime on HBO, now you're in a competition between, like, well, are we going to put out this thing or this new thing? And then that was somebody else developed that. I mean, there's a lot of that in networks. We're like, well, somebody else developed that project, and I don't care about that project. I got this project. So we sort of ran into some of that turbulence.
The same way at any network.
Yeah.
When the previous administration develops something, and then those people are flushed out, the incoming people often say, and this is some real talk about the industry.
No,
guys,
it's just
so
like
pay
the record label. It's the same shit.
Yeah,
oh,
like they'll just be like, well, if this thing hits, it's going to make my predecessor look good.
Yeah, it doesn't
and
really
if it
help
doesn't
me.
Hit, it doesn't help me.
So I'm just going to push it out the door.
Yeah. Can I just tell you guys, that's for most jobs, entertainment people.
That's crazy.
We're saying.
So. You know, but I will say. Not everybody out there knows that. It did make me thinking, because Fonte, you said that's what happens in the record industry. I think what we went through, by the way, I had a really good talk with Rafael Sadiq about it.
Oh, wow.
He is such a good person to talk to. Anyway, because he worked with us on the Maya Rudolph thing. But it made me think about, like, how many great albums have I never heard because some fucking executive pushed it out.
Yeah.
But then it also means that, like, some artists just have to have that tenacity to be like, well, I have three albums that are incredible that are never coming out. Now I got to go make a fourth one. I can't imagine it because I've had to do it, but it's incredible to think about the volume of good material that one person has, like, kept back from the world.
Yeah, no, you have to really think, like, if you're an artist just now, you really have to have it in mind. Like, when people say you're in it for the long haul, in your mind, you might be thinking the long haul is, like, 4 years. Mm-hmm. Nigga, that shit is more like 10, 15, 20.
I got a 20. You know what I'm saying? As somebody who has judged some of the diversity writing contest and watched people's career, I mean, some of the scripts some suck, but some are amazing, but then you see people's, especially for black women, I'll say, in half an hour comedy, and we haven't...
How many of those? Like, two?
We haven't run a network one since the 90s. Bowser, and so it's a very sore spot. But
since Living Single?
Yes.
Jesus. Wow.
Yes.
No, what about Grey's Anatomy, no?
I said half an hour comedy, which I care about because they know I'm right hours. we haven't. And it's like, there's guys, there's like, you know, even Cable, there's Saladin, and there's Prentice who's running Insecure. But just for a woman to actually have a voice in half an hour. And I've watched this young lady. And a lot of times what happens is they'll hire diverse writers because they get them for free under a program for a year, fire them, and they have to start every year at the same level as the staff writer.
The other thing that happens is that they'll hire, like, even if somebody, man, woman, gets a job and is like, this is your show, it's greenlit, what America doesn't know is that the network will then go behind and hire this other person to come in and basically sit over your shoulder for the whole time and try and direct and control what you do because they are more in tune with what the network actually wants. And I've seen a lot of frustrated people be like, they have this, be working with this other writer and they don't even get black people. And it's just like, but that's the condition under which you get to put your show on the air. So that happens often.
Yeah,
So like during the time you were saying that, you know, years would go by or wherever would go by before you had a job or, you know, when you were between jobs. How would you support yourself? How do you eat as a writer?
eBay, I know how to do that. I mean, I wrote broke diaries. I mean, but honestly, this is what happens a lot of time. There's so many stories about being, a lot of times there's not a lot of, this is the first show that I've worked on, and I've been out here for 17 years where I've written for a lead black woman, you know? And a lot of times people will think that it's a black girl, she could only write for black women. I'm like, I've lived in a white and a man's world my whole life. I had to learn to navigate this. Like, you literally on paper, I'm the whitest person on earth. Like, Ivy League green. You know? Like, it's like if you didn't, Angela Nissel, what the hell is that? You know? But it's unless they feel like your voice will contribute, they literally look at, a lot of times on these liberal half an hour comedies, they only look at people of color through a people of color lens. Like, even when you're pitching, they'll be like, okay, here's our Latina character, she's going to take salsa lessons, and you're like,
if she's Latina, she probably don't need to take lessons.
I've had such interesting comments with black women about getting staffed on shows. I remember one girl saying her go-to strategy is getting her hair put in cornrows because then people know that she's the authentic black when she comes to that. And I'm not sure. She was like, I do it every year and it works. She was like, until before that, you know, and it's...
You watched any of either you two ladies, have y'all watched the Love Is at all? Because it kind of shows like the process...
But I heard it does show what she went through.
That's right,
you two
would
watch Sharon Diallo. I'm sorry to me.
Is that on Netflix?
It's on OWN, right?
And it's the story of Mara. And I thought, about the salon.
I watched Greenleaf.
Yeah, I haven't watched Greenleaf.
That's my motherfucking show. Y'all sleeping on Greenleaf.
Nah, my mother loves it.
Very much.
I love it.
I just asked about that because they show her being a staff writer for Martin back in the day before she became who she is, Mara Brockenkill, and supporting her husband.
To me, those are the most interesting parts of the show.
Yeah, yeah. Like showing the Martin part.
The love story part is like some BDSM shit. But like, it's
word?
Now I'm in.
It's just
wait. Is that Mara? Is that her new show?
Yeah.
Oh, I auditioned for that show.
What?
I never heard back.
What were you, seriously?
And now I'm here. What happened, y'all?
What happened? Oh, on the show? Or what happened?
Yeah, what happened on the show?
Would you audition for?
What role did you audition for?
I don't even remember.
Oh,
I thought you was joking.
No, I told you. I auditioned for that show. Because I've had to meet with Mara and her husband.
Right.
Yeah.
Who are like the dream team. Yeah. You know, it's like straight up.
It's a it's
but that show is about their ascent through
their early days.
That's crazy.
And they tell it through the story of them being older. So two older actors telling the story.
Yeah, Clark Peters, and I cannot remember the lady's name. Lester Freeman from The Wire, and I can't remember the lady that plays the older
but Vanessa, version of Mara. Vanessa Bell Calloway's on there, too.
Yeah, Vanessa Bell Calloway. She played the home.
I watch.
Love her.
I love her. But when I was in the OG room, that was my first, that's my first writing job. First time ever writing in the room. I've been a comedian for 20 years, touring all across the country. You know, got on the tour with Tracy, and he was like, I want to put you in my room. I like the way you write, like your jokes. So I got in the room, and I thought that was just how it was. I thought this was normal. And then Andrew's like, no, you never see this many black writers in one
wow.
room. I thought this was, because I loved it. It was like I was home. We had so much fun in the room. We were so loud that the other rooms would come over to see what we were doing.
I thought you were going to say, they would say, can you guys keep it down over here?
I think they did want to say that. But when they opened the door and see all these black people, they're like, okay, we can't really say that. We can't say nothing. You know?
We funny and we squab.
Yeah.
It was good.
But I thought that was normal. And I heard all these stories like, no, this is a first.
But you have to have a successful show with somebody like Tracy, who the network is now in tremendous financial business with, must listen to, like Donald at FX, to be able to get to that place where you can have those types of rooms. Because, again, it's like they meddle in every little part of it.
That's
and you have to have somebody at the top who's just like, don't do that. Okay. This is what's going to be.
All right, so The Room. Of course, you know, in the past year or so, the Me Too movement has at least started to steer, the idea of Me Too has started to, create some dialogue about respect in the writer's room and in the boardroom or whatever. But at its worst, can you tell us, Angela, how toxic?
Woo! I mean, what's interesting to me first before about the Me Too movement is that when I was on Scrubs, there was a black writer's assistant, and she actually bought a lawsuit against the Friends writers for some of the things that they said. Things that
I remember
that's a famous.
You know, and it's it actually got rejected. The whole thing was that
she never worked again.
Yeah, she never worked again. She had to retire from the business.
And they stopped hiring black women. They stopped.
Literally, I was told to my face. Thank you for saying that, because I was told to my face by numerous white men, wow, you're lucky you already have a job, because we ain't hiring no black women after that. And then, like I said, since the 90s, we ain't run one damn show.
They literally said
they can say whatever they want to say to you.
What was her claim? What was
I don't want to misquote, but it was some of the things that they would say in the room. And I mean, they would talk
sexual stuff.
Yeah, okay. And this is not stuff that I have not heard. I've heard it over and over, and I've always been told, by the white women, one, keep your mouth shut, you know, which is what everyone does. And I've been, and especially even looking at the Me Too movement now, I'm rolling my eyes at Tracy across the room, because every black woman who has come out in the Me Too movement, it's like, even the only one that Harvey Weinstein talked back against was the black
woman. He's like, I definitely did not rape her.
That was the funniest thing.
I did not follow her.
He didn't. Y'all go, hell no.
He didn't deny any of them except for that one. He was like,
hey, don't be absurd.
Wait a minute.
I might jack up on some plants, but a black woman, come on.
A black woman, it's like, man.
Have some decency, people.
You go through this knowing that if I speak up, nobody's going to have my back. You know, so it's, I always feel bad, because she was the one, if anyone was one of the first people to speak up, it was her. And now they sued her for the cost of their legal defense. You know?
Yeah. Motherfuckers. Yeah. Where's she at? I want to put her on the shoulder.
And they talk about that case all the time. It comes up a lot.
It comes up in our HR meetings to this day.
Yeah,
those awful 2-hour meetings. We just had
a network meeting came up there.
So she came before the Me Too madness.
Oh, this is like late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh, this was about 98, 99. 2000, I didn't start out here until 2002, so it had to be like...
It's early 2000s.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I remember... But yes, they did, like you said, they said...
Do any of you know where she is or who she is? Or
No.
I mean, you could...
I'm sure she never worked in the...
I know some people who have tried to reach out to her. She went into the military, which I would do too if I had all these powerful men trying to... But that's all I know, and I know that some journalists have tried to reach out to her.
She got her training on. She got some skills.
But... But Ange, talk about too in the room the difference between like, because you know it's jokes, right? You can tell sexual jokes and whatnot, but when it becomes offensive, like what would have made her be like? Because you've experienced some shit in the Scrubs room.
Yes, I will say that what makes you cross the line. I will say that in these jobs, I always liken it to going onto a construction site. I put on a different hat. I put on protective gear when I go in these rooms, and I give as good as I get. But there are certain things that I've heard in rooms like.
What does that mean?
That means that if you're going to sit there and talk about my ass, I'm going to make up shit about your dick, and I'm going to sit there and I'm going to talk about your mom and your brother and all that other shit, and I'm going to make you crawl under the motherfucking desk. Like, for real. Like, you're I'm just, like, you know, like, I'm just, you can't be, in my opinion, you can't be like, oh,
you can't be no bitch, nigga.
Like, literally, I'm not going to go into a room and talk about one of the things, like, we talk about how, one of the things we talk about in the last OG, because there's a white guy there, and I said, you know, white guys, it's so funny when they try to have sex with a black woman, they're always trying to compete with what they think black men do, you know, so I go into a half an hour spiel about having sex with white guys. I can't put out that much on a table where have people visualizing my vagina and not expect them to come back with a joke about it.
Right. Right.
So then what is crossing the line?
Me is watching a basketball game and using the N-word and looking at me and expecting a laugh.
Wait, what? Wow. Wait. Really?
Yes. Yeah. And then, but then getting into the whole thing.
Wait, they felt that safe to say nigga?
Again, like.
Like it was not, like no we heard, repercussions?
We heard earlier, if they felt safe enough to say, we're not going to hire another black woman after this one black woman messed up. What if someone said, we're not hiring another white man? But yes, of course, yes. These are all things that
what
have
you
happened.
Gonna do? You
and
see
you can't
what
go to
her?
HR because.
HR looks out for their company. HR is not going to look out for
HR
you.
HR ain't your motherfucking friend.
HR ain't your friend.
Yeah. HR is the company.
But it also,
friend.
It would. I mean, the other reason you don't go to HR is because it'll hurt your. Like, if you want to stay a writer,
yeah, if, you want to
if
stay
people
a writer,
are going like, okay, we got to hire another room. If I'm like, oh, well, that person who they hired last time, they went to HR based on some jokes that was made. Then
you basically went to internal affairs.
Yeah, then it's like, why would I bring that person? I mean, even.
The black kid didn't have a gun.
So it kind of hurts you. By the way, even with the Me Too movement, I'm pretty sure we've only seen a very small snippet of people who have stories. There's a lot of women. Probably every woman in Hollywood has a story about some shit that somebody did, but you know, again, it's
don't
like,
want to rock the boat.
There's a cost benefit going on. People going like,
is it worth me?
Is it worth me? Not? Is it worth not working?
I don't want to. It's sad to say, but I don't want to be the person now after I see what happens to that other girl that anyone ever says it. Well, you know what? Angela's the reason they're not hiring any more black women. You know, it's sad, but I don't want to be that person.
No, as black people, we always have to think about that. We always have to think in terms of the collective. Like, if I do something. It ain't just me doing it. I represent 30 other niggas that don't even know me. And yeah, that's what's fucked up.
But every room culture is also different. Like some rooms, you know, and it's absolutely sexist, it's absolutely racist, but some rooms are just like hard rooms, period, where depending on how the showrunner is, like I've definitely been in rooms where I've seen two even white guys viciously going at each other and everybody's laughing and I'm like,
at each other like personally, like it's
getting real personal.
Because y'all talked about
on some like
whatnot?
Your wife shit and like whatever. That's why your wife, you know, whatever that was.
But
some showrunners encourage that because they think it makes the show better to have a feisty room. So it actually it's like sometimes people want that Thunderdome atmosphere.
yeah, true.
You know,
really,
yeah. People who we worked before like. I've heard directly from some very famous producer that his assistant was like, well, you know, he likes it when the writers compete a lot and are really kind of cutting each other's throats. And I was like, really? I don't like that.
Yeah,
it's not fun to go to work every day knowing, like, if this person says something to me, I'm going to talk shit about him and then almost come to blows with this person and fight this person, you know, in a building.
But I will say for the most, to write a TV show. My personal experience is that most writers' rooms have a general, like, you like the people that you're in the room with and it becomes like this sort of weird family where, like you said, all secrets kind of come out on the table and you typically grow pretty close. I can't speak on what it was like to be in one of those all male rooms in like, you know, the early 90s where every writer was a white guy. I don't know what that's ever been like. I've never been in that room.
It's amazing. Me and Tracy were talking before we started recording today and we were like, it's, the real world knew that they had something. We are trapped in a room with each other for sometimes up to 12 hours a day. Sometimes we sleep overnight with each other.
Yeah.
And unlike on TV, on the real world, and all these shows, but we are forced to talk to each other about topics that we think will engage America. So it's like, and we are going to disagree. And if you have a good room, it's very diverse and everyone has diverse opinions. So that's why sometimes fists will fly. Sometimes people will say things and people will call out people's dead moms. Like, it gets super real.
I had to hold back one day. Remember, Ange? I had to hold back. I got up. Boy. It was something I just didn't agree with that we were doing with our female character. And I just like, I was holding it in, and I think I said, y'all gonna get letters. I think that's what I said. I said, y'all gonna get letters, and I just got up.
Y'all got outvoted, or
it was kind of a misunderstanding. Yes. But I'm glad that happened, because the showrunner then said, oh, did you think I meant this? Mm. And then other people in the room said, well, that's what I thought you meant.
Yeah.
So, and I thought nobody in the room at that moment had my back, but then everybody was like, no, we were right on the same page with you on that, you know? But they say you're not supposed to do that.
How receptive are, like, in the rooms? Because I'd imagine now, being that, you know, with, like, Black Twitter and, you know, how, like, shit it is instant, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how receptive are people, or I guess whether it be the showrunners or the producers or the higher-ups, whoever, how receptive are they to y'all's, like, feedback of saying, like, yo,
we're gonna y'all get do this, back.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you're gonna be on BASA the next morning, nigga. Like, you don't want these problems. Do they listen to y'all on that kind of shit?
Well, it depends. I mean, so much can change by the time it's on the page to the time that it's on the stage. And then sometimes by the time Black Twitter says something, we're like, oh, they're gonna hate this because we already filmed it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
it depends. I think sometimes I try to fight for that in the room, you know. And you don't wanna be, they call the wet blanket in the room. You don't wanna be that person. But, you know, certain things, like if I feel really passionate about it, sometimes what I'll do is I'll just talk to that showrunner alone, you know,
yes.
And we'll talk alone, because sometimes in the room, something might, you know, it might pop off. So I just go and say, I'll wait till I can talk to him privately.
I would assume that post the Roseanne situation, that most writers' room know that Black Twitter or the internet, social media, has the power to get you canceled in a millisecond. So... was it before then they were just like, oh, it doesn't matter?
I think these conversations always say, in fact, I'll even say there are times when me and Bashir don't agree about a line of dialogue. You know, like, so I don't even think it necessarily has to be a white-black thing. Like, there can be some times when, like, two Black people disagree about, like, what's going to set off Black Twitter.
Well, no. I didn't mean a white-black thing. I just meant the power of the instant feedback from an audience.
I'm gonna be an outlier here and say I think people are extremely attuned to that, but my personal feeling is it is terrible to be attuned to that, because it's going to stop you from taking bold strokes, making bold decisions. And you also have to look at the genesis and origin of something. Like, there's something on our new show that's a little bit controversial, but a Black writer pitched it. It was a room full of Black people there who laughed when he pitched it. I was there. You know what I'm saying? So it's like it's almost like there's a line between if it's coming from us versus if it's like a white TV show with a Black character, where it's like, well, there's no agency there, but it's also case by case. And you know, I apologize for being repetitive, but I personally do feel like if you live your life constantly like worried about, well, what's Twitter going to think about this, then I don't know what kind of life you're living.
No, yes, I completely agree.
I'm with you, because it's also, sometimes I'll see that Twitter gets so excited just seeing Black faces on the screen, and I want to scream at Twitter, there's no Black writers on that show. Yes, there's no Black gaffers. Yeah. There's not even a Black man on the craft food service
Black
table.
Black folks just,
you know,
the mascots for the show.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so it's. I sometimes wish that, and a lot of people on Black Twitter perhaps have their own agendas when they rail against or for
totally.
A show.
You just got to be careful with that.
Yes,
shit.
So I agree with you totally. By
can I just say also, like, I'm to that point. Also, I myself have prejudices. Like, I was talking to this Black woman at this event one time, and I was asking what her favorite TV show was, and I thought she was going to be like, well, you know, Insecure and Atlanta, and like name all the shows that are like the shows that people were talking about. She just named a bunch of random shit that I didn't even know was on the air. And I myself was like, see, that's my prejudice. Because I assumed because she was a Black woman that she's only watching TV shows Ooh. With a strong Black female lead. And like, no, she not was
dangerous.
She was like, the flat. Well, no, but here's why, though. Because when you were in these meetings, when you're talking to these executives, mm-hmm. that's all they talk about. Well, you got to have this person on the show because it's a Black woman, so you have to have a Black
woman. Do you have Black women in your life? Do you take that into account, too? Or does it just become so tunnel vision?
Not at all. Actually, no, not at all. What I'm saying...
not at all does he have Black women in his life.
Exactly. Shout out to my wife.
Oh, you.
Thank you. Was checking with...
Shout out to the wife.
All right, you're invited.
But I was just want to say that I think listening to TV executives, you would think that only people right. only watch
stuff where they themselves are greatly represented on screen. And that's, I think, our feeling, and what we struggle with at HBO, our feeling was that, no, black people are too diverse to be put in a box. Yeah. You cannot tell them what they will like and what they won't like. You can't predict that. You have no idea what a black audience will like.
Which is crazy, because coming from your experience, you can't tell an executive, like, trust me, I know. Yes. I know, like, mad black women. They're like, the numbers say.
But those numbers are subjective.
You know, so now I feel really bad that me and my mom fudged that Nielsen thing. They're like, look at this thing. It says 227.
You know, go on and turn them in anyway. Turn them in.
Damn.
Take a break.
Oh, okay, I figured a jam was coming.
I was playing a jam, but then I thought you were on a thought.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that is all for Questlove Supreme this week. But don't worry, tune in next week, and you're going to hear how this conversation is, all right? Okay, we will see you next go-round. Peace. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.